Hi, I'm James Verdeer, and welcome to the American Institute of Biological Sciences Bioscience Talks, which is a forum for degrading the life sciences. For today's episode, we're joined by Catalina Munciano, who's a researcher at the University of Freiburg in Germany with a background in geography and forest sciences. Also joining us is Volker Radulov, who's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Silvis Lab, where he works on satellite imagery to look at land use. They were here to talk about a very particular kind of satellite data today. It's images from Cold War-era spy satellites, and especially the way that those images can be used to inform current ecological research and also practice. So with no further ado, let's go straight to the interview. Thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking about spy satellite imagery specifically, but I was hoping you could just get us started with a little bit of a primer on, you know, the idea of using satellite data in ecology, and then, you know, kind of more specifically how this application is particularly aided by the use of these old Cold War images.
So this satellite data in general gives us a great view of the entire Earth from up high. So we get an overview of how forests are lost, urban areas are sprawling, agriculture is conducted all over the world. And so it's the most important tool to monitor global change. And most of the satellite image analysis has been conducted with satellites that are publicly available, where the images have been available to researchers since the early 1980s or so. But prior to those civilian satellites, they were already excellent satellites flown by the U.S. Department of Defense in the 60s and 70s. Those images were for a long time we just heard rumors about them or so, but then in the late 90s and the early 2000s, they were declassified, became available for research. And that's the research Catalina and I have focused on.
Perhaps the reason why these historical satellites that Volker mentioned are so interesting to us, or one of the reasons, is because many areas of the globe underwent really large land use changes and ecological changes in the period that they were flown. So it's very exciting for us to capture environmental information that was perhaps poorly documented before.
Okay, I was wondering if we could chat just a little bit about, you know, the geographies that are covered by this spy satellite data. You know, coming at this from a perspective of not knowing anything about it at all, I would make the natural assumption that most of the imagery is going to be of, Cold War opponents, perhaps, you know, so a lot of, you know, former USSR territories. Is it limited to that, or do we have, U.S. spy satellite data of covering wide global swaths?
The data certainly covers really wide global swaths. You have to imagine this as photographs taken on classical film roll as the satellite was orbiting Earth. So there was no turning it on or off necessarily when it was flying over other areas. But of course, image density is higher in areas of military interest during the Cold War period.
Okay, that makes sense. And you bring me to my next question, which is, you know, this stuff was all presumably shot on film because it was before the digital era. You know, where does this film exist? And, you know, has it been sitting in a basement somewhere in a secure government facility? You know, where is this stuff, and how is it becoming available to scientists?
So there are two copies of the film rolls. One is with the National Archives, and the other is with the U.S. Geological Survey. They have literally a big basement full of film rolls in what is called AROS Data Center, that's in South Dakota near Sioux Falls. And when scientists request data, then those film rolls have to be scanned to be able, because they are not going to ship those film rolls to us, they are far too valuable. And someone goes down into the basement, pulls up the corresponding roll and puts it in a scanner. So it's surprisingly low key on that end of the operation. Any images that have been requested once and scanned are then available for anyone else afterwards or so. But so far, less than 10% of the archive has been scanned. So there's still a goldmine of data waiting to be discovered.
That's interesting. And so it would require specific requests from researchers in order to get those data to be available to you?
Correct. Yes. So we would say we have a project recently to map land cover, land use change in the Caucasus Mountains, and we request photos for certain dates that were taken over the Caucasus Mountains, and then they were scanned for us, and we pay a nominal fee for that. The hope in the future is that there may be an initiative to digitize the entire archive and make it available for free, because that would make subsequent research then much easier. You don't have that waiting period of ordering the data and then waiting for it to be scanned and so forth. And it would everyone allow to quickly see what is available and how much that may help their work.
And one thing I was interested in is, you know, what kind of shape is this imagery in when it is made available? Is it georeferenced? Does it have metadata? Is it, you know, easily usable? Can you plug it into ecological study in the same way that you would, say, Landsat data? Or does it take work and manipulation on the part of, you know, researchers to get it up to snuff, so to speak?
So the data, like Volker said earlier, the data comes as scanned imagery. And it requires still quite a bit of pre-processing and preparation to make it usable to sort of scientific inquiry, if you wish, the way that we carry out our research. So one of the first steps is the georectification of the data, and then that's a really big part, of course. And then the second big step that that is necessary is the feature extraction, or the data extraction out of it. And I think why, or one of the reasons why this gold mine has become now interesting to us is that there is sufficient advancement in the technology that we can work in optimizing those steps and speeding up that process, both on the end of the rectification and on the end of the image extraction.
And I feel like, just because of the time that we're in, I'm obliged to ask this question. Is there an AI element to this?
There is an AI element to it. And the reason is that these images are such high resolution that we can see individual buildings and roads and so forth. And so we've done some work with convolutional neural networks to identify building footprints. And we're interested in one thing that's called the wildland-urban interface, where people and wildland vegetation are in close proximity because of the wildfire problems. And so we've used images from the Hexagon missions, extracted buildings, and then mapped wildland-urban interface using these CNNs.
Oh, that's really cool. And I think that brings us to a good moment to talk about the types of research that can be performed, you know, using this technology, this gold mine. What sorts of things are, you know, you looking at specifically, and how does this change your understanding of, you know, perhaps the history of, you know, the land use, et cetera?
I think we can think of three broad types of applications that we have been using the data on, and colleagues from neighboring research fields have. And one that sort of Volker got me hooked up on was mapping ecosystem extents and looking at how the forest cover has changed over long time periods, but also other land uses, that expansion of forest into other habitats, changes in land use such as agricultural cover, and so on. The other application that is quite interesting is extracting information on species population, species habitat use. And that was one example of that was particularly fun to us to address, was the mapping of marmot populations in Kazakhstan, because we could count marmot burrows and use those as indicators of population densities. And then the other is perhaps going more along the lines of Volker's prior example with the wild and urban interface, and generally thinking about human pressures on the environment and changes in, may it be forest harvest, urban expansion, road densities, fishing pressure, so any type of human environmental interactions.
If I may follow up, the one example is work we did with corona satellite imagery for Latvia, so one of the Baltic countries in Eastern Europe. And previously, we had examined how much agricultural land was abandoned after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And a lot was abandoned after the collapse because the agriculture was exposed to global markets, and there was just this huge turmoil when the subsidies and all those systems did not work anymore. But that was always limited to Landsat data. And with Landsat, we can look at the mid-80s, so the late Soviet era, and then the post-collapse after 91 era. With the corona data, we could go back to the 1960s, and to our total surprise, there was more abandonment during the Soviet era than afterwards. It was really widespread, and part of that was because during the Soviet era, they tried to intensify agriculture, and that resulted in abandoning more marginal soils and so forth. But what Catalina mentioned earlier, being able to go back several decades to a time prior to the Green Revolution, prior to the huge increase in the global population, the fastest population rates or so, it makes a huge difference. And it really changes our way of looking at environmental change because we have a baseline that goes further back.
I think if I also may follow up on that, I think one really valuable insight for me from these entire studies, the one in Latvia that Volker mentioned and many others more, is this idea that we have actually overseen quite a large amount of change in the environment that has happened. And oftentimes, without having that context of the historical changes, we might missing that context might lead us to a complete misunderstanding of the current environmental conditions or situations. And to give an example for that, and again to come back to our marmots, one of the conclusions that we would have drawn just looking at recent data on marmot populations in Kazakhstan might have been that marmots actually fare very well in agricultural landscapes because the burrow densities in agricultural landscapes were higher than in other places. And only looking at the historical data have we actually discovered that there was a decline in the marmot population, and that decline came particularly from areas that were under like agricultural use for a very long time. And marmots being philopatric species, they like to stay in the same place once their natural habitat got converted to agriculture. They stayed there, but then over time their population decreased because of the land use pressure. Similar story in Romania with forest use and forest harvest patterns prior to 1990s. Romania has been in the news a lot for the high rates of forest loss that it's experiencing, has experienced after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But when we looked back in time, the rates of forest harvest were three times higher in the 1960s than they are today. And that, of course, changes very much the dynamics in the forest today due to these historical pressures on the system.
So it's a case in which you have ecosystems adapting and species adapting in ways that you wouldn't know about if you didn't have a way of looking back at this historical data.
Exactly. And it can tell us in some places that the history of intensive human land use is actually longer than we expected. And that can mean either that the environment is under stronger pressure or that is able to cope with human pressure better than we thought. Mm-hmm. It also sometimes gives hopeful stories. And in our work in the Caucasus, we use the corona 1960s data to track changes within protected areas, within national parks and wildlife refuges and so forth. And what we could see is that those areas had actually quite a bit of vegetation recovery that the non-protected areas did not. So they were working in favor of establishing more wildlife habitat for some of the large ungulate species that are of concern in that country. So we get both good and bad news out of being able to go back for the decades, but it's important information either way.
Yeah, is there potential for the learnings that come from the use of this data to inform potentially management decisions that are being made about landscapes right now?
Absolutely. And the example of the protected areas would suggest is, yes, they work, and they actually worked through a time of huge social upheaval or so when the Soviet Union collapsed. So that provides good justification to establish more protected areas. The other thing that we can learn is that historic land use often exerts legacies on what the environment today is like. And by understanding that those legacies can be many, many decades, sometimes centuries, with the corona data, we can go back to over half a century. That also then says, well, whatever we do now will exert the same legacies for many decades in the future. And we need to take that into account when making management decisions.
That's fascinating. It sounds like we get, you know, that sort of long-term view that there really wouldn't be otherwise any way to get, because if there was not, you know, a team of scientists on the ground viewing things at the time, you'd have no other way of knowing.
Yeah, and the ground data is still critical, and we can combine that with the satellite images, but the spy satellite images are really the only source to allow us to look at large areas in a consistent manner.
And perhaps to build on that, one really exciting thing about this data is that it allows us to look into regions where perhaps other ground data is not, or ground data is not available for those times. And on the other hand, there are regions like here in southwestern Germany, where we work now with this data, where there are a lot of other historical data sources that can be used for validating this data. And this is, of course, special in some sense, because not many regions of the world have that benefit of other historical data sets for validation. But that's valuable, because then we can perhaps think about, you know, developing models and algorithms in these areas, and then testing them in areas which lack otherwise historical information.
And I'm wondering now about the quality of these images and how they compare with contemporary, you know, satellite imagery that we're getting now. Is it good? I gather that it's all in black and white. Do you have a high degree of fidelity with them? You know, what kinds of things are you able to see? What kinds of things can't you see that you perhaps wish you could?
Of course, like with modern remote sensing images, the quality of the data varies greatly. And so this was a continuously developing program that collected both high resolution and lower resolution imagery. So there is great variability. But one nice way to think about it is that this imagery is a historic version of Google Earth. So you can think about it as the best quality images, like the hexagon data that Volker mentioned earlier, being really Google Earth in black and white of the 1960s or so.
Yeah, so overall, the data is amazingly detailed. And when thinking back when this program was run or so, the engineering behind it is marvelous. The resolution is in the few meters, 2 meters, 5 meters or so. So that means when we analyze the logging in Romania in the 1960s, we can see the clear cuts for sure, but we can also see the rafts of the logs that were cut on the rivers. So that, if you want to know whether this is harvesting or not, that's pretty darn good evidence. So the imagery was so detailed because it was used to count rockets and airplanes and tanks in the Soviet Union or so. And it has one feature that most current satellite data does not, and that's the technical term stereoscopic view. That's a fancy word of saying they took two images from two different view angles. The reason was that it allowed them to see 3D and measure the length of rockets when they were standing on the launch pad. And that tells you a lot about how far those rockets may be able to fly and whether they can reach the US. But that stereoscopic view is then what can tell us nowadays something about the height of trees and so forth. So it's the information content is amazing. It is not the same as modern day satellites. It's like a old film versus a digital camera. There are different things you can do with it or so, but we can see a lot.
That's really fascinating. And I have a question that's probably a little bit outside of your area, but I know people are going to wonder, how the heck did they get these film canisters from the satellites back into the hands of those who would put them in a repository?
So the biggest concern for the program was that the Soviet Union should never know how much the US could see. But they did need to get the film back. So what they did was that the films were loaded on a film canister in the rocket during the satellite mission, and then deployed back to Earth somewhere over the Pacific, close to Hawaii, and then came down with a parachute, and that parachute needed to be caught in the air. So they had either two airplanes with the chain between them flying so they would catch the ropes of the parachute, or later then single airplanes with a big U-shaped device flying behind it or so. To my knowledge, they only lost one canister in all of the missions. When that canister then hits the ocean surface, there's a salt prop in it so that the salt water will destroy the film. There are also submarines circling underneath to make sure that the Russians cannot recover any film canister and so forth. So there was a very elaborate operation. In the later, the amount of film is also stunning. In the later missions by Hexagon, they had up to 60 miles of film on one single mission. And so Kodak had a special factory and building in Rochester that it was a highly secure facility that would prepare film only for the Hexagon mission so that it was thin enough that you could load that much film and still shoot it into space.
And I think you touched on it a little bit, but I just wanted to make sure we capture, you know, how much of this film is there? We were talking about decades worth of data. What's the total like? How much material do we have to work with potentially?
I don't have a good answer to it. And part of it is because so much of the imagery has not been scanned. And to the best of our knowledge, everything has been declassified, but we don't fully know that either. So they have declassified imagery in several stages. But whether that's now all out or not, that's not information that would be shared with us.
I guess the one number that we do have information on that is that there are more than 1 million images in the archive right now on the ARIS website. But
Okay, I understand. So we know that we have a whole lot of imagery and a whole lot of data, but we have unknown unknowns about the potential for there to be other data out there that we have not yet had a chance to learn about. What types of things, do you think could be interrogated using, these images in the future? What's next for your work, in a sense? What kind of projects are you looking to undertake? What are the next horizons for this type of research?
To me, one really exciting step to look forward into the future would be to harmonize this entire data at global level. Now, this is a huge endeavor, and it would require a lot of collaboration between the data holders, but also geographers and remote sensors and experts in computer imaging, probably. To get this going. But I think the dream is to get, for me at least, to get a picture of the global ecosystem state, in the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah, I second that. And in terms of the research that is currently already being done, there's quite a bit of archaeological work too, because people can see archaeological sites before fields were plowed up and so forth. People studying glaciers are using the data too to see how much glaciers have retracted due to climate change. And they can also use this height information that I mentioned earlier to see not only if the glaciers becoming smaller, but also if it's becoming thinner. I think in the areas of understanding human settlements, urban growth, there's a lot to be done. Roads is another issue. So I have one student now who is interested to look at the increase in the density of roads in Mongolia, which has fairly unmanaged road development or so, because everything is open range and people can drive everywhere. So, but I think the Corona and Hexagon data, it's older than the age of most people alive today. And so it allows them to see the world at a time, before they were born. And that gives a different reference point for what the world could be look like in the future. The other thing I want to point out is, the reason this was done was to count rockets. And in many ways, the Corona and Hexagon programs is what kept the Cold War cold. Before those satellite images were available, assumptions by the US of how many rockets the Russians had were vastly inflated. And before that, then the Air Force and so forth said, oh, the US needs far, far more rockets just to keep up with the Soviet Union. And then came Corona first and then followed by Hexagon. It became clear that, yes, the Russian arsenals are impressive, but not nowhere near at what was feared. That allowed the US then in turn to not build as many rockets. And that, if they had built those, would have terrified the Soviet Union, of course. So that's the history. That's why this program was started. And it was by far, it's more expensive than the entire Landsat program has been to date. It was a huge program that drove much of the US space program or so. So the using the program that in the 1960s and 70s solved what was arguably the biggest global threat then, to use it nowadays to deal with what may be the biggest threats now, climate change, land use change, and the destruction of the environment, I think is a really nice connection to our history.
Yeah, that really is fascinating. And I think that, you know, you've given us today a really exciting view on, you know, this program's past, present, and future, and, you know, sort of the unity between those. So thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And that concludes this episode of Bioscience Talks. Just a reminder, the journal Bioscience is published by Oxford University Press on behalf of the American Institute of Biological Sciences and is made possible by the support of our members and donors. Thank you, and talk to you next time.